hugged me.
What has your doctor told you?
That it's serious. That it can be fatal.
I saw the gravity of that wash over her face. The hurt, the pain. Claire was a doctor, a pathologist. She had taken in what was at stake before I even met her eyes. I told her that I was already undergoing packed red cell transfusions twice a week.
"That's why you wanted to get together the other day," she declared.
"Oh, Lindsay,
why couldn't you just tell me?"
None of my past reasoning seemed clear now.
"I wanted to, so much. I was afraid, maybe even more to admit it to myself. Then I allowed myself to get wrapped up in the case."
"Does anyone know? Jacoby? Rolf?"
I shook my head.
"Raleigh?"
I took a breath.
"Still think I'm ready for Mr. Wright?"
"You poor baby," Claire said softly. "Oh, Lindsay, Lindsay, Lindsay."
Her body was shaking. I could feel it. I had hurt her. Suddenly I let it all go, fear and shame and uncertainty rushing through me. I held on to Claire, and I realized she was all that kept me from hurtling out of control. I started to cry, and then we both did. It felt good, though. I wasn't alone anymore.
"I'm here for you, sweetheart," Claire whispered. "I love you, girl."
Chapter 41. The murder in Napa changed everything. There were blistering attacks on the way the SFPD was trying to solve the case. We took heat from everywhere. Sensational headlines announced the handiwork of a sadistic, deranged, completely new kind of killer. Out-of-town news crews buzzed around the hall. Tragic wedding pictures and wrenching family scenes were the lead on every TV newscast. The task force that I was heading was meeting twice a day. Two other inspectors from SCU and a forensic psychologist were added on. We had to provide our files for the FBI. The investigation was no longer confined to some embittered figure lurking in David or Melanie Brandt's past. It had grown larger, deeper, more tragic and foreboding. Canvassing area wine shops, Jacoby's team had unearthed a few names, nothing more. The bloody jacket was leading us nowhere, too. The problem was the tux style was from 4 or 5 years ago. Of the 15 Bay Area stores, not one maintained records of manufacturers' styles, so it was virtually impossible to trace. We had to go over their records invoice by invoice. Mercer tripled our investigators. The killer was choosing his victims with careful precision. Both murders had taken place within a day of the victims' marriages. Both reflected specific knowledge of the victims, their lodgings, their itineraries. Both couples still had most of their valuables, watches, wallets, jewelry. The only things missing were the wedding rings. He had dumped the DeGeorges in a seemingly isolated place, but one where they were sure to be found. He had left other blockbuster clues for us to follow up. It didn't make sense. "The killer knows exactly what he's doing, Lindsay. He knows what you're doing. Link the crimes." I had to find out the common denominator, how he knew his victims, how he knew so much about them. Raleigh and I divided up the possibilities. He took whoever had booked the Brants and the DeGeorges' itineraries, travel agencies, limo services, hotels. I took planners. Ultimately, we would find some link between the crimes.
"If we don't make progress soon," Raleigh grumbled, "there'll be a lot of priests and rabbis in this town with a shitload of dead time. What's this maniac after?"
I didn't say, but I thought I knew. He was after happiness, dreams, expectations. He was trying to destroy the one thing that kept all of us going. Hope. Chapter 42. That night, Claire Washburn took a cup of tea into her bedroom, quietly closed the door, and started to cry again.
"God damn it, Lindsay," she muttered, "you could have trusted me."
She needed to be alone. All evening long she had been moody and distracted. And it wasn't like her.
On Mondays, a night off for the symphony, Edmund always cooked. It was one of their rituals, a family night. Dad in the kitchen, boys cleaning. Tonight he had cooked their favorite meal, chicken and capers and vinegar. But nothing had gone right, and it was her fault. One thought was pounding in her. She was a doctor who dealt only in death. Never once had she saved a life. She was a doctor who did not heal. She went into her closet, put on flannel pajamas, went into the bathroom, and carefully cleansed her smooth brown face. She looked at herself. She was not beautiful, at least not in the way society taught us to admire. She was large and soft and round, her shapeless waist merging with her hips. Even her hands, her well-trained, efficient hands that controlled delicate instruments all day, were pudgy and full. The only thing light about her husband always said, was when she was on the dance floor. Yet in her own eyes she had always felt blessed and radiant, because she had made it up from a tough, mostly black neighborhood in San Francisco to become a doctor. Because she was loved. Because she was taught to give love. Because she had everything in her life that she ever wanted. It didn't seem fair. Lindsay was the one who attacked life, and now it was seeping out of her. She couldn't even think of it in a professional way, as a doctor viewing the inevitability of disease with a clinical detachment. It pained her as a friend. The doctor who could not heal. After he and the boys had finished the dishes, Edmund came in. He sat on the bed beside her.
"You're sick, kitty cat," he said, a hand kneading her shoulder. "Whenever you curl up before 9 o'clock, I know you're getting sick."
She shook her head.
"I'm not sick, Edmund."
"Then what is it? This grotesque case?"
Claire raised a hand.
"It's Lindsay. I rode back from Napa with her yesterday. She told me the most awful news. She's very sick. She's got a rare blood disorder, a form of anemia. It's called Negley's aplastic."
"It's severe, this Negley's anemia?"
Claire nodded, her eyes dim.
"Damned severe."
"Oh, God," Edmund murmured. "Poor Lindsay."
He took her hand, and they sat there for a moment in stunned silence. Claire finally spoke.
"I'm a doctor. I see death every day. I know the causes and symptoms, the science, inside out. But I can't heal."
"You heal us all the time," Edmund said. "You heal me every day of my life. But there are times when even all your love and even your amazing intelligence can't change things." She nestled her body in his strong arms and smiled.
"You're pretty smart for a guy who plays the drums. So what the hell can we do?"
"Just this," he said, wrapping his arms around her. He held Claire tight for a long time, and she knew he thought she was the most beautiful woman in the whole world.
That helped.
Chapter 43. The following afternoon, I got my first glimpse of the killer's face. Chris Raleigh was talking to the people who had handled the victim's travel arrangements. I was checking into who had planned their weddings. Two different companies. For the DeGeorges, white lace. For the Brants, a fancy consultant, Miriam Campbell. That wasn't the link. I was at my desk when the duty clerk put through a call. It was Claire. She had just returned from examining the bodies of the victims with the county coroner in Napa. She sounded excited.
"Get over here," she said. "Hurry."
"You found a link. Becky DeGeorge was sexually disturbed?"
"Lindsay, we're dealing with one sick dude."
"They were definitely in the act when they were killed," Claire told me minutes later when I met her in the lab. "Semen traces found in Rebecca DeGeorge matched those I scraped off her husband, and the angle of the wounds confirmed what I suspected. She was shot from behind. Rebecca's blood was all over her husband's clothes. She was straddling him. But that's not why I asked you here." She fixed her large, wide eyes on me, and I could tell it was something important. I thought it best to keep this quiet, she said. Only the local ME and I know.
Know what, Claire? Tell me, for God's sake.
In the lab, I spotted a microscope on a counter in one of those airtight petri dishes I remembered from high school biology. As with the first victims, she said excitedly, there was additional sexual disturbance of the corpse. Only this time, it wasn't so obvious. The labia was normal, what you would assume post-intercourse, and there were no internal abrasions like with the first bride. Toll missed it, but I was looking for signs of additional abuse. And there it was, inside the vagina, sort of shouting, "Come and get me, Claire!" She picked up the petri dish and a tweezer and gently removed the top. Her eyes lit up with importance. Out of the clear dish, she lifted out a single half-inch red hair.
"It's not the husband's?"
Claire shook her head. "Look for yourself." She flicked on the microscope. I leaned in, and against the brilliant white background of the lens, I saw two hairs. One thin, shiny, black-brown. The other, short, curly, sickle-shaped.
"You're looking at two sections from Michael DeGeorge," she explained. "The long one's from his head, the other is genital."
Then she placed the hair from the petri dish on another slide and inserted it in the microscope lens bay, side by side with the others. My pulse was starting to race. I thought I knew where she was going with this. The new hair was reddish-brown in hue and twice the thickness of either of DeGeorge's. It had tiny filaments twisted around the cortex. It clearly belonged to someone else.
"It's neither cranial nor pubic. It's from a beard," Claire announced, leaning over me.
I pulled back from the scope and looked at her, shocked. The killer's facial hair had turned up in Becky DeGeorge's vagina.
"Post-mortem," she said, to drive it home.
Chapter 44. As Claire said, we were piecing our killer together step by step. His height, his face, his fetishes. The way he murdered. Now I had to figure out how he was tracking his victims. Raleigh and I were going full force on the travel and wedding planner thing. We had 15 detectives out there following up leads. Now that we had a facial characteristic, we went back to the guests, combing them for a guy in a beard who might have been seen trolling around. I felt confident that some aspect of this widening search would yield results. One of the guests would have noticed someone. We would discover a travel agent in common, a leak somewhere, or one of Jacoby's searches would come up with a match. The following morning, Hartwig called in.
"Sparrow Ridge Vineyards. It's owned by a group here known as Black Hawk Partners. A local guy, Ed Lester, an attorney, puts together real estate partnerships."
"You know where he was over the weekend?"
"Yeah, I checked. Portland. He ran in a marathon there. I caught up with him when he got back to the office. He was definitely in Portland."
I still felt certain that whoever had dumped the bodies there hadn't stumbled on the remote vineyard by accident. It meant something to the killer. "He owns this place outright?"
"Uh-uh. Black Hawk puts together deals. They bring in outside money from well-heeled guys down your way. People who want to break into the wine game. Lester acts as the managing partner."
"So who's he partnered with on this one?"
"I don't know. Investors."
I sucked in my breath, trying to remain patient. "Which investors?"
"Generally, investors who want to remain private. Listen, Inspector, I know where you're heading, but this guy only deals with pretty established people. Believe me, anyone could have found that dump site. Real estate agents, someone who checked it out, anyone local. I have to deal with these people long after you're gone."
I cradled the phone in my neck and spun around in my seat toward the window. "This is a multiple murder investigation, Lieutenant, the worst I've ever seen. The dump site is 3 miles up a deserted dirt road. Anyone riding around in the dark with two bodies could have safely dumped them any time before. Whoever did this had to know the vineyard was there. And I don't think it's a local. I don't think he would draw attention so close to where he lives.
Come back to me when you know who Lester's partners are."
I hung up on Hartwig.
some of my optimism began to unravel. Raleigh turned up nothing on the travel agents. The Brants had booked through Travel Ventures, a society agent that catered to a high-end crowd. The DeGeorges had used Journey Time, out of Los Altos. We had people scour through the personnel records of both firms. There was no connection between the two. No cooperative arrangements, not a single travel agent who had worked for both of them. It was possible someone had tapped into their systems, said the manager of Journey Time, but finding such a person was next to impossible. My end was equally disappointing. I had the files from both wedding planners, engravers, bands, photographers, caterers, florists. Nothing matched up. The Brants and the DeGeorges had lived in two separate worlds. However the killer was identifying the victims, I hadn't found a clue. Chapter 45. I called Claire and Cindy together for a second meeting of the girls. This time the mood was decidedly different. There was no laughter or high fives, no festive margaritas. Two more people were dead. We had no suspects, only a widening case. Clues that were rapidly leading nowhere, intense pressure coming down on all of us. Claire was first to arrive. She hugged me and asked how I was feeling. I don't know, I admitted. I had gone through three treatments. Sometimes I felt strong. At other times, especially in the afternoon, I felt like a ghost of myself. Medved said he'd review my red cell count next week. Cindy arrived next. She was wearing a halter top under a man's plaid shirt, a pair of embroidered jeans. She was very pretty and city cool. I hadn't spoken to her since Monday, when I had let her run with the story of the second killings. Even holding her story back for a day, she had still scooped the city. I guess I'm buying, she announced. She tossed us a new business card with the bright red logo of the Chronicle on it. I read the card. Cindy Thomas, reporter, Metro Crime Desk. We toasted her with warm congratulations, then we roasted her a little just to keep her ego in check. What else were friends for? I told them that the travel agents and wedding planners had led nowhere. A couple of things really bother me, I said. The gun. Sexual killers don't usually change methods. The methods are part of the sexual thrill. It's a strange combination, agreed Claire. He's so in control when he plans his strikes. He seems to know everything. Where they're married, room numbers, what their honeymoon itinerary is, how to get away. Yet when he kills, he's close to rage. It's not enough to merely kill them. He has to defile. I nodded. That's the key. He's striking at weddings. Something about them is intolerable to him. But I think his obsession's with the brides. Both of the grooms were dispatched quickly. It's as if they didn't even matter to him. But the brides, that's his real fascination. So, where would this guy go, I asked aloud, to scout potential victims? If you wanted to kill brides, where would you check them out?
They had to choose a ring, suggested Claire. A jeweler.
Or City Hall, said Cindy. They'd need a license. I looked at her and chuckled. It would sure fit if a government employee was behind this.
Postal employee, Claire and Cindy spoke simultaneously. Photographers, said Claire.
I could see a twisted bastard hiding behind the lens. They were all good possibilities. It only required time and manpower to check them out before the killer struck again.
This bride business isn't exactly my expertise, I said to Claire. That's why you're here.
What happened to all that three-shop cookies crap, she laughed, and the part about my being a top-notch M.E.?
There was a ripple of frustrated laughter around the table. We all took another sip of beer. The Women's Murder Club. This was good. No men allowed.
Where's the goddamn link? I asked. He wants us to find it. That's why he's leaving clues. He wants us to uncover the link.
Everyone was silent, lost in thought.
I can feel it, I went on, in the ceremony, the celebration. He finds something that drives him into psychopathic rage, something he needs to stamp out. Hope? Innocence? The husband he kills right away, but the brides? How does he find the brides?
If he's living in this twisted dream world, said Cindy, thinking aloud, he would go to where the fantasy was the strongest, the most vivid. He might want to build up his anger by observing them in an unsuspecting state.
Then Claire looked at us with a spark in her eye. I was thinking, I'd go where they bought their wedding dresses. That's where I would pick the victims out.
Chapter 46. When I got to work the following morning, there was a fax from Hartwig, listing the partners at Sparrow Ridge. I gave them to Jacoby to check. Then I called my contacts at both wedding planners, White Lace and Miriam Campbell. I wasn't expecting much. So far, everything had come back empty. To my shock, both planners confirmed it. Melanie Brandt and Becky DeGeorge had bought their dresses at the same place. The bridal boutique at Saks. It was the first tangible link between the two cases. It could lead to nothing, but I felt in my bones it had the real promising sensation of something good. I was at Saks by the time the store opened at 10. The bridal boutique was on the third floor, tucked away in a corner next to gifts and fine china. I caught Marianne Perkins as she was arriving for the day, a cup of steaming coffee in her hand. The department manager was a stylish, affable woman of about 50, just the type who would work with brides for 20 years. She had someone cover for her and sat down with me in a cluttered back room filled with magazine photos of brides. I was devastated when I heard it, she said. She shook her head, ashen-faced. Melanie was just here 2 weeks ago. She stared at me glassily. She was so beautiful. My brides are like my children, Inspector. I feel as if I've lost one of my own. One? I fixed on her eyes. You haven't heard?
Heard what?
I told Marianne Perkins about Becky DeGeorge. Shock and horror swept over her face. Her green eyes bulged, welled with a rush of tears. She stared through me as if she were looking into the wall. Oh, my God. She took in a heart-jolting breath. My husband and I were at our cabin in Modesto for a few days. She was just in. Oh, my God. What's going on here, Inspector? An immediate flood of questions tumbled out. Who would know about their customers? Other salespeople? Managers? The killer had been pegged as a male. Did any men work in the department? Each of these questions elicited a disbelieving negative response from Marianne Perkins. The staff had all been together for a minimum of 8 years. No males. Just like our murder club. She leaned back in her chair, scrolling her memory for any details that she could muster. We were admiring her. Becky, she was stunning. It was as if she had never thought of herself in quite that way, but seeing herself in her dress, it suddenly became clear. Her mother had given her this brooch. Pearls, diamonds, and I ran back to the office for flowers. That's when I noticed someone standing over there. She pointed. He was staring in Becky's direction. I remember thinking, see, even he thinks you're beautiful. I remember now. Frantically, I took down a description. Late 40s, maybe younger. I didn't get a really good look, the bridal manager said. He had a beard. I was sure it was him. It confirmed that Claire was right. Saks had to be where he found his victims, where he tracked them. I pressed her hard. How would anyone find out details about someone's wedding? Dates, locations, where they would honeymoon? We keep that information, Marianne Perkins said, when the girls choose a gown. Some of it we need to know to help us, like dates, deadlines, and it just helps us get a feel for the bride. Most of them register with us as well. A feel for the bride. Who has access to this information? She shook her head. Just us, my assistants. It's a small department. Sometimes we share it with fine china and gifts. I felt I was finally close. My heart was slamming inside my chest. I need to see a copy of anything you have on Melanie Brandt and Becky DeGeorge, and every customer you're currently working with. He He was spotting his potential victims here, wasn't he? There was a good chance he would come back. Someone on the store's list could be next in line. I saw Miss Perkins's jaw drop. She appeared to be focusing on a horrible sight. "There's something else you'll want to know."
"What?"
"About a month ago, after inventory, we noticed that our folder on the brides was missing." Chapter 47. As soon as I got back to the hall, I did two things. I called Claire and Cindy and told them what I'd found out at Saks. Then I went to find Chris Raleigh. I shared everything with Chris, and we decided to put a woman detective from the sex crimes unit inside the department store. I sent a sketch artist over to see Marianne Perkins at Saks. Then Chris shared something important with me. Roth and Mercer had handed over our case files to the FBI. I felt a knifing pain deep in my chest. I rushed into the bathroom, closed the door behind me, pressed my back against the cold, chipped tile.
"Goddamn son of a bitch controlling men! Goddamn Roth and Mercer!"
I stared at my face in the mirror. My cheeks were flushed. My skin was burning. The FBI? This was my case! And Claire's and Cindy's and Raleigh's. It meant more to me than any other I'd ever worked on. Suddenly my legs felt wobbly. "Negley's?" The doctor had said I'd be feeling fits of nausea or lightheadedness. I had my fourth transfusion scheduled at Moffitt, the hematology unit, at 5:30. An overwhelming emptiness tugged at me, alternating between anger and fear. I was just starting to crack this thing. I didn't need outsiders in dark suits and tie pins buzzing around with a clumsy, ham-handed alternative investigation. I blinked into the mirror. My cheeks, which had been burning with anger, now looked pallid and lifeless. My eyes were watery and gray. My whole body seemed drained of color. I stared at myself until a familiar voice came alive inside me.
"Come on! Get yourself together! You win! You always win!"
I splashed cold water on my face. The flashing sweat on my neck began to subside. "You're allowed one of these," I exhaled with a thin smile. "Just don't do that again." Gradually, a familiar glimmer came to life in my eyes, and normal color seeped back into my cheeks. It was 4:20. I had to be at Moffitt by 5. I'd start on the names from Saks tomorrow. After applying a few dabs of makeup, I made my way back to my desk. To my chagrin, Raleigh wandered up.
"Now you can manage their fallout,"
I snapped unnecessarily, referring to the FBI.
"I didn't know," he said. "As soon as I did, I told you."
"Yeah," I nodded. "I know." Raleigh got up, came around, and sat on the edge of my desk, facing me. "Something's wrong, isn't it? Tell me. Please." How did he know? Maybe he was a much better detective than I gave him credit for. For a moment, I wanted to tell him.
God, I wanted it to come out.
Then Raleigh did something totally unexpected. He flashed one of those trusting smiles that I couldn't help but give myself over to. He pulled me out of my chair and gave me a hug. I was so surprised I didn't even resist. I was quivering jelly in his arms. It wasn't quite sexual, but no burst of passion had ever rippled through me more powerfully. Raleigh held me until the anxiety had slowly melted away. Right there, in the fucking squad room, I didn't know what to do, but I didn't want to pull back, or have him let me go. "I could write you up for this," I finally mumbled into his shoulder. He didn't move.
"You want a pen?"
Slowly I pulled myself away. Every nerve in my body felt as if it had retreated from a tense state of alert. "Thanks," I muttered with appreciation.
"You didn't seem yourself," he said gently. "Shift's almost done. Want to talk about it over coffee?" "Just coffee, Lindsay. Not a date."
I looked at my watch and suddenly saw that it was almost 5 o'clock. I had to be at Moffitt's. I gave him a look that I hope reflected, "Ask me again," but said,
I can't. Gotta go.
Chapter 48. The pretty, smiling reservations clerk politely nodded for the next person in line.
Welcome to the Lakefront Hilton, sir.
Philip Campbell stepped up to the counter. He noticed her name, Kaylin. Bright-eyed, bushy-bushed Kaylin. He smiled back, flirted subtly. He handed her a confirmation slip.
First time with us, Mr. Campbell?
The desk clerk asked in a high-pitched chirp. He smiled, let her know that it was. As she punched in his reservation, he followed her movements, thoughtfully stroking the rough hairs of his beard. He wanted her to notice, to remember his face. Maybe something he said. One day, when some diligent FBI agent came by with a drawing or photograph, he wanted this chirpy little squirrel to think back and recall this moment in a close and chilling way. He wanted her to remember everything. As he had with the saleswoman in the bridal boutique at Saks.
"Here for a visit to the museum, Mr. Campbell?"
Kaylin asked as she typed.
"For the Voskul wedding," he volunteered.
"Everyone's saying that,"
she smiled. He followed the click of her peach-colored nails against the keys as she typed.
"I've got you a deluxe room with a beautiful view," she said, handing him a key.
She smiled.
"Enjoy the wedding, and have a nice stay."
"I will,"
Campbell said pleasantly. Before he turned away, he caught her eye and said,
"Speaking of weddings, I like your ring."
Upstairs, he pulled the curtains aside, and, as promised, before him was a sweeping view of Cleveland, Ohio. Chapter 49. I saw him. That bastard. What was he doing here? In a large, fast-moving crowd on Lower Market. Just a quick movement in the throng, fighting its way toward the ferry. My blood froze with the sight of him. He was wearing an open blue shirt, brown corduroy jacket. He looked like some college professor. On any other day, I could have passed him by, never noticed. He was thin, gaunt, totally unremarkable in every way but one. It was the reddish-brown beard. His head bobbed in and out of the crowd. I followed, unable to narrow the distance. "Police!" I shouted over the din. My cry dissolved into the hurrying, unheeding mass of people. At any moment I might lose him. I didn't know his name. I only knew his victims. Melanie Brandt, Rebecca DeGeorge. Suddenly he stopped. He bucked against the flow, turned right toward me. His face seemed illuminated, shining against a dark background like one of those medieval Russian icons. Amid the commotion, our eyes met. There was a moment of captured, enlightened recognition. He knew that it was me, that I was the one after him. Then, to my horror, he fled. The swarm of people engulfed him, swept him away. "Stop!" I shouted. "I'll shoot!" A cold sweat broke out on my neck. I drew my gun. "Get down!" I cried, but the rush-hour commuters pushed on, shielding him. I was going to lose him. The killer was getting away! I raised the gun, focused on the image of his red beard. He turned, with the sneer of someone who had totally outwitted me. I drew a breath, steadied my aim. As if in slow motion, every face in the crowd turned toward me, too. I stepped back. In horror, I lowered the gun. Every face had the same red beard. I had been dreaming. I found myself at my kitchen counter, blinking into swirling circles in my glass of Chardonnay. There was a familiar calm in my apartment. No rushing crowds, no fleeing faces. Only sweet Martha, lounging on her futon. A pot of boiling water was steaming on the stove. I had my favorite sauce ready to go. Ricotta, zucchini, basil. A CD was on. Tori Amos. Only an hour ago, I had had tubes and IV lines sticking out of me. My heart had kept pace to the metronome-like rhythm of a monitor's steady beep. Damn it! I wanted my old life back. My old favorite dreams. I wanted Jacoby's sarcasm. Sam Roth's scorn. Jogging on the marina green. I wanted kids. Even if it meant I had to get married again. Suddenly, the downstairs buzzer rang. Who would be here now? I shuffled over and said, "Who is it?"
"I thought you had somewhere to go,"
a static voice replied. It was Raleigh. Chapter 50.
What are you doing here?
I called back in surprise. I was pleased, but suddenly tingling with nerves. My hair was pulled up. I was in an old Berkeley t-shirt that I sometimes slept in, and I felt drained and anxious from my transfusion. My little place was a mess.
Can I come up? Raleigh said.
This business or personal? I asked. We don't have to go back to Napa, do we?
Not tonight, I heard him laugh. This time I brought my own.
I didn't quite understand that, but I buzzed him up. I ran back to the kitchen, turned the heat down on the pasta, and in the same breath threw a couple of pillows from the floor onto the couch and transferred a pile of magazines to a chair in the kitchen. I put some lip gloss on and shook out my hair as the doorbell rang. Raleigh was in an open shirt and baggy khakis. He was carrying a bottle of wine. Cundy.
Very nice.
He tossed me an apologetic smile.
I hope you don't mind me barging in.
Nobody barges in here. I let you in, I said.
What are you doing here?
He laughed.
I was in the neighborhood.
The neighborhood, huh? You live across the bay.
He nodded, abandoning his alibi without much resistance. I just wanted to make sure you were okay. You didn't seem yourself back at the station.
That's nice, Raleigh, I said, looking into his eyes.
So? Are you?
So? I was just feeling a little overwhelmed. Roth, this FBI thing. I'm fine now, really.
I'm glad, he said. Something smells good.
I was just throwing something together. I paused, thinking about what I wanted to say next. You had dinner?
He shook his head. No, no, I don't want to intrude.
That why you came with the wine? He flashed one of those irresistible smiles.
If you weren't home, I have a corner on 2nd and Brannan I always head to.
I smiled back and finally held open the door. Raleigh came into my apartment. He looked around with sort of an impressed nod, gazing at some of the pottery, a black and gold satin baseball jacket from Willie Mays, my terrace with its view of the bay. He held out the bottle. There's one already open on the counter, I said. Pour yourself a glass. I'll check on the food. I went into the kitchen, reminding myself that I had just come from the outpatient clinic for a serious disease, and we were partners anyway. With an irrepressible flicker of excitement, I took out an extra place setting.
Number 24, Giants, he called to me. This warm-up jacket is the real thing.
Willie Mays. My father gave it to me for my 10th birthday. He wanted a boy. I kept it all these years. He came into the kitchen, spun a stool around at the counter. While I stirred the penne, he poured himself a glass of wine.
You always cook for yourself like this?
Old habit, I said. Growing up, my mother worked late. I had a sister 6 years younger. Sometimes my mother didn't get home till 8. From the time I can remember, I had to make dinner.
Where was your dad?
Left us, I said, whipping together some mustard, grapeseed oil, balsamic vinegar, and lemon into a vinaigrette for the salad. When I was 13.
So, your mother brought you up?
You could say. Sometimes I feel like I brought myself up.
Until you got married.
Yeah, then I sort of brought him up, too. I smiled. You're pretty nosy, Raleigh.
Cops are generally nosy. Didn't you know that?
Yeah, real cops.
Raleigh feigned being hurt. What can I help you with, he offered.
You can grate, I said, and grinned. I pushed a block of Parmesan and a metal grater his way. We sat there as he grated, waiting for the pasta to cook. Sweet Martha padded into the kitchen and let Raleigh pet her.
You didn't seem yourself this afternoon, he said as he stroked Martha's head. Usually you handle Roth's bullshit without even blinking. Seemed like there was something wrong.
Nothing's wrong, I lied. At least not now. If you were asking.
I leaned against the counter and looked at him.
He was my partner, but even more than that, he was a person I thought I could trust. It had been a long, hard time since I'd put my trust in anybody whose gender started with an M. Maybe in a different time, I was thinking. Tori Amos's haunting voice hung in the air.
You like to dance? Raleigh suddenly asked.
I looked at him, really surprised. I don't dance. I cook.
You don't dance. You cook, Raleigh repeated, scrunching up his brow.
Yeah. You know what they say about cooking. He looked around.
What I'd say is that it doesn't seem to be working. Maybe you should try dancing.
The music was soft and languorous, and as much as I tried to deny it, part of me just yearned to be held. Without my even saying yes, my goddamn partner took my hand and pulled me from around the counter. I wanted to hold back, but a soft, surrendering voice inside me said, "Just go with it, Lindsay. He's okay. You know you trust him." So I gave in and let Chris Raleigh hold me. I liked being in his arms. At first we sort of stood there swaying stiffly. Then I found myself letting my head fall on his shoulder and feeling like nothing could ail me, at least for a while. "This isn't a date," I muttered. I let myself drift to a real nice place where I felt love and hope and dreams were still there to reach for. "To tell the truth," I told Raleigh, "I'm glad you stopped by."
"Me too."
Then I felt him hold me close. A tingle raced down my spine, one that I almost didn't recognize anymore. "You've got it, don't you, Raleigh?" I said.
"What's that, Lindsay?"
"Soft hands." Chapter 51. Kathy and James Voskuhl were having their first dance. And, to break with tradition, it was a rocker. The driving beat of La Bamba jolted through the brightly lit atrium of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland.
"Everybody," the groom shouted, "rock and roll, join us!"
Hip young girls with dyed hair and wearing shiny green and red prom dresses, 60s style, swung around on the dance floor, their partners in retro silk shirts, Travolta-like. The bride and groom, having changed into party garb, joined in, butting thighs, whooping, arms in air.
"It almost ruined everything," Philip Campbell thought.
He had wanted her in white. And here she was, sweaty, red-streaked hair, cat-eye-shaped glasses, a tight green dress.
"This time, Kathy, you've gone too far."
40 tables, each with the likeness of some rock and roll icon as a centerpiece, filled out the great hall of the museum. A glittery banner that hung from the glass roof proclaimed, "James and Kathy." After a loud crescendo, the song ended. A throng of sweaty wedding guests milled back toward their tables, catching their breath, fanning themselves. Waiters in black waistcoats scurried about the room, filling wine glasses. The bride went over and embraced a happy couple in formal dress. Mom and Dad. Philip Campbell couldn't take his eyes off her. He saw her father give her a loving look, like, "We've come through a lot, honey, but now everything will be all right. Now you're part of the club. Trust funds and country day, little peach-haired grandkids." The groom wandered over and whispered something in Kathy's ear. She squeezed his arm, flashing him a smile that was both affectionate and coy. As he walked away, the tips of her fingers lingered, as if she were saying, "I'll be right along." With a hitch of his belt, the groom drifted out of the main hall. He glanced back once or twice, and Kathy waved. Campbell decided to follow, hanging back at a safe distance. He went down a wide, well-lit corridor off the atrium. Halfway down, James Voskuhl glanced back once, cautiously. Then he opened a door and went in. The men's room. The killer moved forward. No one else was in the hall. He felt an irrepressible urge building with force. His fingers made their way into his jacket pocket, touched the cold heel of the gun. He flicked the safety off. He could no longer control what was going on inside his head.
"Go in,"
a voice dared him.
"Do it."
He entered a filmy, sallow light. No one at the urinals or sinks. The groom was in a closed stall. A pungent smell filled his nostrils. Marijuana.
"That you, love?" the groom's affectionate voice called out.
Every wick-like nerve in Campbell's body stood at attention. He mumbled something barely audible.
"Better get in here, hon," the groom gulped, "if you want the end of this bone."
Philip Campbell pushed open the door. The groom looked up, bewildered, the tip of a joint on his lip.
"Hey, man, who the hell are you?"
"I'm the one who kills useless worms like you."
With that, he fired. Just once. James Voskull's head snapped back. A splatter of red sprayed against the tile. The groom rocked once, then crumpled forward in a heap. The echo of the gun blast seemed to concuss the entire room. It left an effluvium of cordite that mingled with the pot smoke. A strange calm took over Philip Campbell. A fearlessness. He pulled the groom's head back and set him upright. Then he waited. The sound of the outer door opening and echoes of the distant party rushing in went right through him.
"That you, Vosk?" a woman's voice called out.
It was her, the bride.
"What are you smoking in there, tar?"
Kathy giggled. She went over to the sinks, and he heard the sound of running water on. Campbell could see her through a crack in the stall. She was at the sink, thrashing a comb through her hair. A vision came to him. How he would set this up. What the police would find. It took everything he had to control himself, to let her come to him.
"You better save me a hit or two, mister," the bride called out.
He watched her dance over to the stall. So close now, so unbelievably delicious. What a moment. When she opened the door, it was her look that meant everything to him. The sight of James, red drool leaking from his mouth, the startled recognition of the killer's face suddenly clicking in, the gun aimed right at her eyes.
"I like you better in white, Kathy," was all the killer said.
Then he squeezed the trigger, and a blinding white flash exploded through the cat-eye lenses. Chapter 52. I was in early Monday morning, feeling a little nervous about my first contact with Raleigh after our dancing and dining experience, wondering where all this was going to go, when one of the task force inspectors, Paul Chin, rushed up to me.
"Lindsay, there's a woman in interrogation room 4 I think you should check out."
Ever since a physical description of the assailant had hit the airwaves, people had been calling in with fake sightings and dead-end leads. One of Chin's jobs was to follow them up, no matter how unlikely.
"This one a psychic or a police buff?" I asked with a skeptical smile.
"I think this one's the genuine article," said Chin. "She was at the first wedding."
I almost leaped out of my chair after him. At the front of the squad room, I spotted Raleigh coming in. Chris. For a moment, a tingle of pleasure rushed through me. He'd left about 11 after we ended up polishing off both bottles of wine. We ate, chewed over our separate stints on the force, and the ups and downs of being married or single. It had been a sweet evening. Took the heat off from the case. It even got my mind off Negley's. What scared me a little was the tremor inside that it could be something more. I had caught myself staring at him Friday night while he helped out with the dishes, thinking, if times were different. Raleigh ran into me, carrying coffee and a paper.
"Hey," he smiled, "nice vest."
"Chin's got a live one in 4, I said, grabbing his arm. "Claims to have a physical sighting. You want to come along?" In my haste, I was already by him, not even giving him a second of recognition. He put down his paper on our civilian clerk's desk and caught up on the stairs. In the cramped interrogation room sat a nicely dressed, attractive woman of about 50. Chin introduced her to me as Laurie Birnbaum. She seemed tight, nervous. Chin sat down next to her.
"Miss Birnbaum, why don't you tell Inspector Boxer what you just told me?"
She was frightened. It was the beard that made me remember. I didn't even think of it until now. It was so horrible.
"You were at the Brants' wedding?" I asked her.
"Yes, as guests of the bride's family," she replied. "My husband works with Chancellor Weil at the university." She took a nervous sip from a cup of coffee. "It was just a brief thing, but he gave me the chills."
Chin pushed down the record button of a portable recorder. "Please, go ahead," I told her soothingly.
Once again, I felt close to him, the bastard with the red beard. I stood next to him. He had this graying red beard, like a goatee, the kind they wear in Los Angeles. He looked
older, maybe 45, 50, but there was something about him. I'm not saying this right, am I?
You spoke to him? I asked, trying to communicate that even though she didn't do this every day, I did. Even the male detectives admitted that I was the best at Q&A on the floor. They joked that it was a girl thing.
I had just come in from the dance floor, she said. I looked up, and there he was. I said something like, nice affair, bride or groom. For a moment, I thought he looked kind of appealing. Then he just sort of glared at me. I took him for one of those arrogant investment banker types from the Brandt side.
What did he say to you? I said. She massaged her brow, straining to recall.
He said, in the weirdest way, that they were lucky.
Who was lucky?
Melanie and David. I may have said, aren't they lucky? Meaning the two of them. They were so stunning. And he replied, oh, they're lucky.
She looked up with a confused expression on her face.
He called them something else. Chosen.
Chosen?
Yes. He said, oh, they're lucky. You could even say they were chosen.
You say he had a goatee?
That's what was so strange. The beard made him seem older, but the rest of him was young.
The rest of him? What do you mean?
His face, his voice. I know this must sound strange, but it was only for a moment as I came off the dance floor.
We got as much as we could from her. Height, hair color, what he was wearing. Everything confirmed the sparse details that we already had. The killer was a man with a short, reddish beard. He had been wearing a tux, the tux jacket he had left behind in the Mandarin suite. A fire was building inside me. I felt sure that Laurie Birnbaum was credible. The beard, the tux, we were piecing together his appearance.
Is there anything more, anything at all that stands out to you? Some physical characteristic, a mannerism?
She shook her head.
It happened so quickly. It was only when I saw the drawing of him in the Chronicle.
I looked at Chin, conveying that it was time to call down an artist to firm up the details. I thanked her, made my way back to my desk. We'd get a sketch from her to use along with the one from Marianne Perkins at Saks. The murder investigation had entered a new phase. It was very hot. We had a stakeout operational outside the bridal boutique at Saks. One by one, we were contacting the names on the store's list. Anyone who had ordered a wedding dress in the past several months. My heart was pounding. The face I had imagined, my dream of the red-bearded man, was starting to fill in. I felt we had him contained. My phone rang.
Boxer, I answered, still shuffling through the names in the Saks wedding folder.
My name's McBride, a deep, urgent voice said. I'm a homicide detective in Cleveland.
Chapter 53.
I got a homicide here that fits the pattern of what you've been dealing with,
McBride explained.
GSWs, McBride continued. Both of them. Gunshot wounds right between the eyes.
He described the quick but grotesque deaths of Kathy and James Voskuhl, killed at their wedding at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. This time the killer hadn't even waited for the wedding to end.
What kind of weapon your guy use in Napa? McBride asked.
9mm, I told him.
Same.
I was reeling a little bit. Cleveland? A voice pounded inside me. What the hell was Redbeard doing in Ohio? We had just made the breakthrough, found out where he was casing his victims. Did he know that? If so, how? Cleveland was either a copycat killing, which was entirely possible, or this case had just broken wide open and could lead anywhere. You have crime scene photos there, McBride? I asked. McBride grunted.
Yeah, got them right in front of me. Nasty. Sexually explicit.
Can you get me a close-up of their hands?
Okay, but why the hands?
What were they wearing, McBride? I heard him shuffling through photos.
You mean rings?
Good guess, detective, yeah. I was praying that it wasn't our guy.
Cleveland? It would shatter everything that made me feel we were close to him. Was Redbeard taking his killing act across the country?
A minute later, McBride confirmed exactly the thing I didn't want to hear.
There are no wedding bands.
The bastard was on the move. We had a stakeout going where we thought he might show up, and he was 2,000 miles away. He'd just murdered a couple at their reception in Ohio. Shit, shit, shit!
You said the bodies were found in a sexually explicit position? I asked McBride with dismay. The Cleveland cop hesitated. He finally said,
The groom was shot sitting on the john. We found him there, sitting up, legs open. The bride was shot in the stall, too, as she was coming in. There was enough of her brains on the inside of the door to confirm it. But when we found her, she was face down. Her face was stuffed between his legs.
I was silent, forming the image in my mind, hating this cruel, inhuman bastard more every day.
You know, fellatio style, McBride finally managed. There's a few things my investigators want to ask you.
Ask me yourself. I'm going to be there tomorrow. Chapter 54 6:30 the next morning, Raleigh and I were on our way to Cleveland, of all places. McBride met us at the plane. He wasn't how I had imagined him. He wasn't flabby, middle-aged, Irish Catholic. He was intense, sharp-boned, maybe 38, and black.
You're younger than I thought,
he smiled at me. I smiled back. And you're definitely less Irish. On the way into town, he brought us up to speed.
Groom's from Seattle. Had something to do with the music business. Worked with rock bands. Producer, marketing guy. Bride grew up here in Ohio. Shaker Heights. Father's a corporate attorney. Girl was cute. Redhead, freckles, glasses.
He pulled a manila envelope off the dashboard and tossed it over to me in the passenger seat. Inside were a series of glossy 8x11s of the crime scene. Stark, graphic, somewhat resembling old photos of gangland rubouts. The groom was sitting in the stall with a surprised expression, and the top of his head blown off. The bride was slumped over his lap, curled in a pool of blood, hers and his. The sight of the couple filled me with a cold dread. As long as the killer was in Northern California, I felt we had him contained. Now he was on the loose. We grilled McBride about the venue, how the victims might have ended up in the men's room, and what security was like at the Hall of Fame. Each answer I heard convinced me even more that it was our guy. What the hell was he doing here? We pulled off the highway at Lakeshore Boulevard. A modern skyline rose all around us.
There she is, McBride announced.
From a distance, I saw the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame glinting up ahead like a jaggedly cut jewel. A twisted killer had struck in the city's most celebrated venue. By now, he might already be back in San Francisco. Or Chicago? New York? Topeka? Planning another gruesome double murder. Or maybe he was in a hotel room across the square watching us arrive. Redbeard could be anywhere. Chapter 55 It was the third time in 2 weeks I had to go over a harrowing double murder scene. McBride walked us up to the second floor and through an eerie, empty atrium devoid of pedestrian traffic to a men's bathroom blocked off by crisscrossing yellow crime tape and cops. Public bathroom, Raleigh said to me. He's getting nastier each time. This time there were no bodies, no horrifying discoveries. The victims had long been transferred to the morgue. In their place were grim outlines of tape and chalk. Gut-wrenching black-and-white crime photos were taped to the walls. I could see what had happened. How the groom had been killed first, his blood smeared on the wall behind the toilet. How Redbeard had waited, surprised the bride as she came in, then moved Kathy Voskul into the provocative position between her husband's legs. Defiled her.
How did they both end up here in the middle of their wedding? Raleigh asked.
McBride pointed to a crime scene photo on the wall.
We found a smoked-down joint next to James Voskul. Figured he came here to cop a buzz. My guess is the bride came in to join him.
No one saw anything, though? They didn't leave the reception with anyone? McBride shook his head. I felt the same smoldering anger I'd felt twice before. I hated this killer, this savager of dreams. With each act, I hated him more. The bastard was taunting us. Each murder scene was a statement, each one more degrading.
What was security like that night? I asked. McBride shrugged.
All exits except the main one were closed down. There was a guard at the front desk.